And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to the Hamilton and broader community, as well as the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And we're resuming our live broadcasting. I'm pleased to say we have Stephen Gowans with us. Of course, he's one of our favorite guests on this program. He's an Ottawa-based writer, journalist, blogger, and commentator. Been featured recently on interviews on RT, Russia Today, and elsewhere. Let's see if we've got him on the line. Stephen, can you hear me?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I'm glad to catch you. A bit of noise on the line. Hopefully that will go away. But I know you've been covering Egypt. You've been following those uprisings, those revolts, those changes for several weeks now. You've written four, maybe five articles on your blog. In fact, let's help people find that. Your blog's name is What's Left, and that's at gowans.wordpress.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, excellent. Well, you've increasingly become a go-to person looking at democratic changes, uprisings, things in which there might be United States involvement, or looking at what's happening on the ground, who's asking questions that need to be asked. And that's what Steve does. For weeks, we've been witnessing these revolts across the Middle East, North Africa. And you've been looking at Washington's response. I know you mentioned statements by the New York Times reporter, Mark Landler, and he was commenting on Washington's reaction to what was happening in Egypt. And that reporter said, Washington is proceeding gingerly, balancing the democratic aspirations of young Arabs with cold-eyed strategic and commercial interests. So I guess it's okay for Washington to view things in a strategic manner. Do you think that's been Washington's attitude?
Yeah, I mean, there's a conflict for Washington between, as the New York Times reporter pointed out, its commercial and geostrategic interests, and then its rhetoric about being kind of, in the vanguard of promoting democracy. And the reporter was arguing that the U.S. government had to step gingerly because its commercial interests and its geostrategic interests take precedence over its rhetoric or over any kind of democracy promotion or real democracy promotion. So it had to kind of balance the optics. It was going to pursue its commercial and economic and geostrategic interests, but at the same time make it look as if it was really interested in democracy and the uprising in Egypt.
Well, you talk about protecting interests. What do they mean by interests? Whose interests? What interests are these? Are they national interests, like all of the United States having interests in all of Egypt, all of Tunisia? What do they mean, essentially, by interests?
Right, and that's an interesting phrase that's often used in the media. They simply talk about U.S. interests and U.S. vital interests without actually elaborating on what they are. Someone many years ago once said that it was an abomination of geography and democracy that the United States could have interests in someone else's country. I mean, how could they have interests in Egypt? But the interests are commercial or economic interests, for one. So largely the interests of the shareholders or major shareholders, investors, and corporate executives, for example, in the United States, who are interested in a world that's open to U.S. trade, U.S. exports, and U.S. investment. So that's one of the United States' vital interests, and then they often talk about geostrategic interests, which usually mean military interests, but they could usually be boiled down ultimately to economic interests as well, because these are usually military interests, which mean defending U.S. access to investment opportunities or to vital natural resources, for example.
When you talk about business interests, I guess these are specific interests, not necessarily all American interests. If you're able to outsource a call center to Egypt, for example, I guess that's jobs that aren't going to American workers. That puts downward pressure on wages domestically.
Yes, exactly. So these are the interests, as I said, of U.S. investors and of the affluent or kind of corporate U.S. Class, and often not the interests of the U.S. working class, which, as you point out, by using a good example of the call centers, because there are U.S. call centers in Egypt, there are Canadian call centers in Egypt, or call centers operated by Canadian or U.S. firms in Egypt. And obviously, once you export, these are jobs that would have otherwise been done by U.S. or Canadian citizens that are now being done by citizens abroad. But that's only one example. And I think you could cite many.
Well, you mentioned the C word, class. I know the Taylor Report in Toronto was interviewing Eric Olin Wright about the labor uprisings or the demonstrations in Wisconsin, and it's likely that they'll be able to get him back and talk about just the way Americans use that word or don't use that word, class. I think these discussions are going to come more and more, given what we're seeing in the United States. So it's good that we're recognizing, you know, what our interests, what our business interests. It's hard to think about the term interests or protecting interests, because I think you gave a hypothetical example of Egypt spending billions of dollars to keep a dictator in power in Washington. You know, if that happened, how do we imagine that as interests?
Absolutely. And I think you're trying to point out, when we hear people or the press or the media or anyone talking about vital U.S. interests or vital Canadian interests, whatever the case may be, should ask the question, well, the interests of who in Canada or the interests of who in the United States? And are their interests really aligned with the interests of ourselves or the vast majority of people?
Now, you mentioned that there still is this conflict, this open conflict between supporting democracy and supporting interests, whether they be business interests or military interests. So there's this democracy versus U.S. interests paradigm that the reporters put forward, but you're critical of that too as well. I think listeners of this program probably are already familiar with the various ways the U.S. has supported dictatorships all over the world for 100 years. You said that the U.S. says it values democracy, but it's like saying that you value literature and then throw away your books every time the TV comes on, because their support for democracy seems to evaporate pretty quickly if they think their interests are being threatened.
Well, that's true. And I mean, you can talk, yeah. So you can talk a lot about supporting democracy, but they've been supporting this kind of Mubarak dictatorship, or had been for how many years? For decades. Supporting the kind of absolutist monarchies within the Gulf region. So supporting Saudi Arabia, which is hardly a democracy, and no one in the government of the United States or the U.S. state is really interested in seeing any change in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or any of the many Gulf states, which are really autocracies. And you're right, and the United States has supported dictatorships in many, many places, but at the same time claims to be promoting democracy around the world. So,
well, there have been changes in Egypt, or at least there have been these events over the past few weeks, and you've been able to report on them as they happened. So since the process started, what changes would you say have occurred in Egypt?
Well, you could argue that there really haven't been any changes. I mean, Mubarak is gone, but Mubarakism remains. And by Mubarakism, I mean kind of U.S. domination of Egypt through a local military elite. And I'm reminded of something that was attributed to Bertolt Brecht. Now, I don't know if Brecht actually said this, but whoever said it said something that was interesting. And when there was a lot of celebration over the suicide of Adolf Hitler, the bastard is dead, but the bitch who gave birth to him is still alive. And the same thing is happening here. I mean, maybe Mubarak is gone, but the entire system that Mubarak was sitting at the head of persists. And I mean, first of all, we've had Mubarak sitting or stepping down, but he's been replaced by a military government. The head of the military government is Field Marshal Tantawi, who is known throughout Egypt as Mubarak's poodle. The person who is believed will succeed Tantawi as the head of the military, General Inan, is kind of the Pentagon's poodle, because he's a guy that the Pentagon are very taken with. He's on the phone on a regular basis, a daily, if not hourly basis, with the Pentagon. And if we look at the Egyptian military, you see that the Egyptian military is largely an extension of the Pentagon. Egypt receives $1.3 billion annually in essentially grants from the U.S. government to purchase military equipment. And this money never leaves the United States. This is money that is given to the Pentagon. So what Egypt does is it delivers its wish list to the Pentagon, and the Pentagon then gives the $1.3 billion every year, usually to General Dynamics, which then sends F-16 jet fighters and M1 A1 Abrams tanks to Egypt. The Egyptian officer corps is trained at U.S. military colleges.
So there's a couple of things here. So there's a training issue that the Egyptian military involves training from the United States, but also the equipment, the arms, supplies, the tanks, as you say, come from the United States. This is kind of a handout, right? Because the U.S. it hands money to itself. It goes to the U.S. contractors, and free stuff goes to Egypt. So this is at the expense of the U.S. taxpayers.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a nice subsidy for General Dynamics, which manufactures the F-16 and the tanks, and they get this money every year.
Well, there's an obvious element of dependence here. There's integration here. I guess the real test is if an Egyptian government tries to buck U.S. authority, because the military is very important in Egyptian domestic politics. I guess if there is damaged relations between the U.S. and Egypt, that could affect the Egyptian military and Egyptian politics. What would happen, or what could we expect, if an Egyptian government was moving away from the United States?
Yeah. Well, I should just go back for a second. And one thing I should have pointed out, though, is you asked what's changed in Egypt, and my answer was not much of anything. We have Mubarak stepping down and replaced by someone called his poodle. So this is as if, you know, George W. Bush had been forced to step down and was replaced by Tony Blair. Well, if that happened, no one would say that anything had really changed. Simply, you just changed the person at the top. And then talking about the dependency of the military on the United States, if you change this or turn this around a bit, I think it becomes clear. So imagine that the Soviet Union still existed. And Egypt was once a client of the Soviet Union. Well, imagine it still is. And it receives $1.3 billion annually in grants to buy Soviet MiG jet fighters and tanks. And the Egyptian officer corps is trained at a Soviet military academies. And the top Egyptian generals are on the telephone daily with their counterparts at the Kremlin. And the generals then have formed the government. Well, no one would be in any doubt as to who was really in charge of Egypt. It would be the Soviet Union. So then imagine that you have a civilian government that takes over from the military government. And if you use this Soviet analogy again, so imagine then that the civilian government in Cairo decides that it wants to reorient toward the West and away from the Soviet Union. Well, you know, as a military that receives billions of dollars in annual grants from Moscow, whose officer corps is trained in Moscow, whose top generals are on the telephone daily with their counterparts in the Kremlin, are they going to allow this to happen? Well, probably not. So if a government is stupid enough to try to pursue that policy, you're likely to have a military coup. But what's more likely to happen is the government will recognize that this is going too far, and these aren't the kind of policies we're going to pursue, even if they're in our interest. So the same thing's happening now with in Egypt. Once we have a civilian government, it's going to be very constrained in what it can do because the military exercises enormous influence in the country, and that military is essentially an extension of the United States.
Yeah, it seems that it's difficult for things in Egypt to change. There is that relationship with the United States, and the United States was not too keen on things changing in the first place. They weren't very enthusiastic or supportive of the idea of Mubarak stepping down. They were ambiguous about the whole thing. And that's been the case in a number of these countries where uprisings have occurred. Bahrain is another example of United States not really wanting to change the status quo. We can get into that. And there's a few other countries you could talk about. I guess what's really interesting and what really stands out is the difference between this situation and the situation in Libya, because you have uprisings there, you have revolt, revolutions, and the United States seems to have taken a much different stance. The language is different. Obama on Egypt was talking about negotiation and transition and things like that. In the case of Libya, they were pretty quick to come up with the viewpoint that Gaddafi was finished, it's time for him to move away, right now, stop fighting. So, I guess, on the ground in Libya, would you say that the situation is the same as it was, or similar as it was in Egypt or Tunisia, with, I guess, a sort of client government tottering, just sort of waiting to fall to protest?
No, I think it's different in many respects, but two significant respects in which it's different is that in Egypt, Mubarak had no popular support at all, whereas in Libya, Gaddafi does have an immense amount of popular support, which isn't to say that it's overwhelming, because there are many people who are against Gaddafi too, but he does have his supporters. And the other difference, I think you pointed out, is that Mubarak was a client of the United States and Gaddafi isn't. And because Gaddafi isn't, he's treated in a different way, and the language is different, not only from Obama, but also in the press. For example, you'll notice the language used to describe Libyans who've taken up arms against their government. So they're called rebels and not insurgents or illegal combatants
or militants
and terrorists, which is what they would be called if Gaddafi were a U.S. client. And sometimes they're called Gaddafi's people, as in, you know, Gaddafi is attacking his own people. Well, if that's the case, then Abraham Lincoln ought to be reviled in the United States for attacking his own people in the U.S. Civil War, because that's what's actually emerged in Libya as a kind of civil war.
It's interesting, that kind of language has not emerged in the case of, you know, Bahrain, for example. I saw a video on Al Jazeera and elsewhere. You saw the protests in Bahrain. A guy got shot at point blank with a tear gas launcher. There's reports about the effects of tear gas or whatever gas it is they're using there on people in Bahrain. And you're not hearing about the government of Bahrain or the monarchy attacking its own people. So that language seems to be reserved exclusively for Libya. And in fact, it very much resembles, to me, the language used to describe Saddam in the case before Iraq. So you remember at the outset of this, they were talking about weapons of mass destruction, that Libya might have chemical weapons that it might use on its own people. So there was the weapons of mass destruction, Gaddafi being insane, and so forth. And now the idea of bringing in a no-fly zone to deal with the scenario, sanctions and a no-fly zone. So they've taken a much more, I guess, aggressive approach, much more akin to that of military intervention.
Mm-hmm. No-fly zone, and even now some people talk about a no-drive zone, because now it's said, well, it's too late for a no-fly zone because, of course, the tables have turned on the rebels and they don't have the momentum. And so now some who favor intervention have talked about attacks or NATO attacks, perhaps, or U.S. air attacks on Libyan tanks and ground forces, so a no-drive zone.
Well, that's quite an intervention. That's quite an involvement. It's taking sides, again, differing from the language used in Tunisia or Egypt, because it seems to me you have a case where Libyans, this is for them to sort out. There's pro-Gaddafi or pro-government forces, anti-government forces. There's fighting over that issue. I guess the West seems to be looking for ways in which it can intervene, and it didn't take long for certain kinds of language to come out of the woodwork, the old humanitarian intervention stuff, the responsibility to protect Libyans, stop a genocide from occurring. I guess the United Kingdom has been one of the biggest purveyors of this. They've been calling for the no-fly zone quite heavily. How is this possible? I mean, this language, a lot of it was discredited or believed to be discredited around the time of Iraq. How is it coming back so easily?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's kind of significant that the talk in the press is about Gaddafi attacking his own people. So you have these people who are taking up arms, who are, you could call them rebels or insurgents or whatever you want to call them. But, I mean, if you simply call them Gaddafi's own people, then, I mean, that kind of seems to call forth the necessity of some kind of humanitarian intervention.
Well, that seems to be the drive, because I remember Al Jazeera, other programs, interviewing lawyers and experts in the United States. Most of the people, the Americans they talked to, they're asking the Americans, is it possible to intervene? Can the United Nations, can NATO intervene? On what basis in international law can something be done? And some of the legal experts are trying to say, well, you know, normally international law doesn't allow for this, but if there's a humanitarian situation, etc., then we might be able to invoke responsibility to protect. There are a few others who came out against that that were interviewed, but that's the push, it seems to me. I guess this could intensify civil war if we get involved. A no-fly zone is a form of involvement. Not only is it a military exercise, as has been admitted by U.S. generals, but it implicitly favors one side over the other. It would remove government's capabilities, therefore enhancing the capabilities of the rebels, I imagine. Is that the only form of intervention really being discussed? Is there anything actually happening right now? I know there was the case of the British commandos. Aside from that, are forms of intervention being pursued?
Well, I know that there's still ongoing discussion, I believe, or according to the press, there's ongoing discussion at the White House about the possibilities for intervention. And all kinds of possibilities are being discussed. I mean, the last that I heard was discussion about perhaps targeted airstrikes on Libyan forces. But there doesn't seem to be a great appetite for that at the White House or even in the Pentagon. But if you want to talk about intervention, I mean, one of the problems with intervention, or one of the things we ought to ask ourselves is the United States or NATO or any of the countries calling for intervention, are they really motivated by humanitarian concerns? And harking back to the example of the U.S. Civil War I was using, where you're talking about should we have reviled Lincoln for attacking his own people? I mean, if Britain had contemplated intervening militarily in the U.S. Civil War, would anyone have attributed Britain's motive to humanitarian concern over the safety of the people in the South, or would they have looked at British commercial interests as the motivation? I think they would have looked at British commercial interests. If NATO or if the United States or Britain or France are really concerned about protecting people, then they might show more concern about what's happening in Bahrain, for example, rather than implicitly supporting the Saudi military intervention in Bahrain.
Well, I guess that's okay, Stephen, because the Saudis aren't attacking their own people. They're attacking someone else's people.
That's right.
And that's okay, I guess, according to the new international law that we have. We're speaking with Stephen Gowans, and you can reach his blog, for example, at gowans.wordpress.com. It's entitled What's Left. I guess we only have a couple minutes left, but there was one thing, and that is, as you said, there's been trepidation in the U.S. about intervening in yet another country in a dangerous situation, although there have been moves towards doing so with the naval buildup and so forth. Self-described humanitarians have been saying, we got to do something, we got to get in there, we got to have the no-fly zone, we got to do this, we got to do that. And some people are saying, you know, we got to take sides and support the rebels, support whoever. And there's not a lot of questioning about who is involved in this combat. And I understand some rebel leaders have been on television calling for the no-fly zone or even calling for airstrikes to kill Gaddafi. They said, you know, we don't really want a lot of foreign involvement, but it would be really helpful if NATO or the U.S. could hit Gaddafi with a missile and kill him. Is that typical for rebel groups to call on outside aid, especially from a large superpower bloc like NATO, in order to change conditions in their country?
I don't know if it's typical. I mean, it often happens. But we can ask who is it that in the rebel group or the opposition that's calling for that? Because it does seem to be kind of a diverse group, but it's also interesting to see who the U.S. media regards as being the leaders and kind of appoint as the leaders. And I think the ones who are appointed as the leaders have had a long-term relationship with the United States. There are some people in that opposition and rebel group who have been active with the CIA for decades trying to overthrow Gaddafi. And I suspect that the people who already have an established relationship with the United States that are being kind of promoted or appointed as leaders.
It's interesting because there's diverse groups involved. It's an unclear and unstable situation. And it looks in some quarters as if the United States is trying to groom certain people or associate itself with certain groups. And that could have an impact later on. But again, we'll see how that develops. It's a continuing situation. So I wanted to thank you very much for being here. We should direct people once again to your blog. It's gowans.wordpress.com. russiatoday.com. You're interviewed by several publications. If any Russia Today interviews happen in the near future, you should let us know, catch those interesting videos. But otherwise, yeah, I direct people to your blog, and I hope to see more articles on Libya, Bahrain, and other things. Great coverage you've been doing on Egypt, and I'd love to see that expanded. So thanks for doing all of this, Steve.
Okay, and thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll catch you later.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.